black community the textbook view took over. My most memorable encounter with the Confederate myth of Reconstruction came during a discussion with 17 first-year students at Tougaloo College, a predominantly black school in Mississippi, one afternoon in January 1970. I was about to launch into a unit on Reconstruction, and I needed to find out what the students already knew. "What was Reconstruction?" I asked. "What images come to your mind about that era?" The class consensus: Reconstruction was the time when African Americans took over the governing of the southern states, including Mississippi. But they were too soon out of slavery, so they messed up and reigned corruptly, and whites had to take back control of the state governments. I sat stunned. So many major misconceptions glared from that statement that it was hard to know where to begin a rebuttal. African Americans never took over the southern states. All governors were white, and almost all legislatures had white majorities throughout Reconstruction. African Americans did not mess up. Indeed, Mississippi enjoyed less corrupt government during Reconstruction than in the decades immediately afterward. Whites did not take back control of the state governments. Rather, some white Democrats used force and fraud to wrest control from biracial Republican coalitions. For young African Americans to believe such a hurtful myth about their past seemed tragic. It invited them to doubt their own capability, since their race had messed up in its one appearance on American history's center stage. It also invited them to conclude that it is only right that whites be always in control. Yet my students had merely learned what their textbooks had taught them. Like almost all Americans who finished high school before the 1970s, they had encountered the Confederate myth of Reconstruction in their American history classes. I, too, learned it from my college history textbook. John F. Kennedy and his ghostwriter retold it in their portrait of L.Q.C. Lamar in Profiles in Courage, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Compared to the 1960s, today's textbooks have vastly improved their treatments of Reconstruction. All but three of the 12 textbooks I surveyed paint a very different picture of Reconstruction from Gone with the Wind. No longer do histories claim that federal troops controlled Southern society for a decade or more. Now they point out that military rule ended by 1868 in all but three states. No longer do they say that allowing African American men to vote set loose an orgy of looting and corruption. The 1961 edition of Triumph of the American Nation condemned Republican rule in the South. Many of the carpetbag governments were inefficient, wasteful, and corrupt. In stark contrast, the 1986 edition explains that the Southern Reconstruction legislatures started many needed and long overdue public improvements, strengthened public education, spread the tax burden more equitably, and introduced overdue reforms in local government and the judicial system. Like their treatment of slavery, textbooks' new view of Reconstruction represents a sea change, past due, much closer to what the original sources for the period reveal, and much less dominated by white supremacy. However, in the way the textbooks structure their discussion, most of them inadvertently still take a white supremacist viewpoint. Their rhetoric makes African Americans, rather than whites, the problem, and assumes that the major issue of Reconstruction was how to integrate African Americans into the system, economically and politically. "Slavery was over," says the American way. "But the South was ruined, and the blacks had to be brought into a working society." Blacks were already working, of course. One wonders what the author thinks they had been doing in slavery. Similarly, according to Triumph of the American Nation, Reconstruction meant solving the problem of bringing black Americans into the mainstream of national life. Triumph supplies an instructive example of the myth of lazy, helpless black folk. When white planters abandoned their plantations on islands off the coast of South Carolina, black people were left helpless and destitute. In reality, these black people enlisted in Union armies, operated the plantations themselves, and made raids into the interior to free slaves on mainland plantations. The archetype of African Americans as dependent on others begins here, in textbook treatments of Reconstruction. It continues to the present. When many white Americans believe blacks work less than whites, even though census data show they work more. In reality, white violence, not black ignorance, was the key problem during Reconstruction. The figures are astounding. The victors of the Civil War executed but one Confederate officeholder, Henry Wirz, notorious commandant of Andersonville Prison, while the losers murdered hundreds of officeholders and other Unionists, white and black. In Hinds County, Mississippi alone, whites killed an average of one African American a day, many of them servicemen, during the Confederate Reconstruction, the period from 1865 to 1867, when ex-Confederates ran the governments of most southern states. In Louisiana in the summer and fall of 1868, white Democrats killed 1,081 persons, mostly African Americans and white Republicans. In one judicial district in North Carolina, a Republican judge counted 700 beatings and 12 murders. Moreover, violence was only the most visible component of a broader pattern of white resistance to black progress. Attacking education was an important element of the white supremacists' program. The opposition to Negro education made itself felt everywhere in a combination not to allow the freedmen any room or building in which a school might be taught, said General O.O. Howard, head of the Freedmen's Bureau. In 1865, 1866, and 1867, mobs of the baser classes at intervals, and in all parts of the South, occasionally burned school buildings and churches used as schools, flogged teachers, or drove them away, and in a number of instances, murdered them. With the exception of The American Way and Discovering American History, each of the 12 textbooks includes at least a paragraph on white violence during Reconstruction. 6 of 12 textbooks tell how that violence, coupled with failure by the United States to implement civil rights laws, played a major role in ending Republican state governments in the South, thus ending Reconstruction. But overall, textbook treatments of Reconstruction still miss the point. The problem of Reconstruction was integrating Confederates, not African Americans, into the new order. As soon as the federal government stopped addressing the problem of racist whites, Reconstruction ended. Since textbooks find it hard to say anything really damaging about white people, their treatments of why Reconstruction failed lack clarity. Triumph presents the end of Reconstruction as a failure of African Americans. Other Northerners grew weary of the problems of black Southerners and less willing to help them learn their new roles as citizens. The American Adventure echoes, "Millions of ex-slaves couldn't be converted in 10 years into literate voters or successful politicians, farmers, and businessmen." Because I, too, learned that African Americans were the unsolved problem of Reconstruction. Reading Gunnar Myrdal's An American Dilemma was an eye-opening experience for me. Myrdal introduced his 1944 book by describing the change in viewpoint he was forced to make as he conducted his research. When the present investigator started his inquiry, the preconception was that it had to be focused on the Negro people. But as he proceeded in his studies into the Negro problem, it became increasingly evident that little, if anything, could be scientifically explained in terms of the peculiarities of the Negroes themselves. The Negro problem is predominantly a white problem. This is precisely the change textbook authors still need to make. Their failure to make it lies behind the appalling results of a 1976 national survey of first-year college students, a majority of whom ventured that Reconstruction led to unparalleled corruption among the entrenched carpetbagger governors and their allies in the black-dominated legislatures of the defeated states, precisely the Confederate myth of Reconstruction. Textbooks in 1976 no longer said that, but they failed and still fail to counter this pervasive myth with an analysis that has real power. As one student said to me, "You'll never believe all that stuff I learned in high school about Reconstruction. Like, it wasn't so bad. It set up school systems. Then I saw Gone with the Wind and learned the truth about Reconstruction." What is identified as the problem determines the frame of rhetoric and solutions sought. Murdahl's insight to focus on whites is critical to understanding Reconstruction. Focusing on white racism is even more central to understanding the period Rayford Logan called the nadir of American race relations, the years between 1890 and 1920, when African Americans were again put back into second-class citizenship. During this time, white Americans, North and South, joined hands to restrict black civil and economic rights. Perhaps because the period was marked by such a discouraging increase in white racism, 10 of the 12 textbooks ignore the nadir. The finest coverage in American History summarizes the aftermath of Reconstruction in a section called The Long Night Begins. After the Compromise of 1877, the white citizens of the North turned their backs on the black citizens of the South. Gradually, the Southern states broke their promise to treat blacks fairly. Step by step, they deprived them of the right to vote and reduced them to the status of second-class citizens. American History then spells out the techniques, restrictions on voting, segregation in public places, and lynchings, which Southern whites used to maintain white supremacy. Triumph of the American Nation, on the other hand, sums up in these bland words. Reconstruction left many major problems unsolved and created new and equally urgent problems. This was true even though many forces in the North and the South continued working to reconcile the two sections. These sentences are so vague as to be content-free. Frances Fitzgerald used an earlier version of this passage to attack what she called the problems approach to American history. "These problems seem to crop up everywhere," she deadpanned. History in these texts is a mass of problems. 500 pages later, in Triumph, when the authors reach the civil rights movement, race relations again becomes a problem. The authors make no connection between the failure of the United States to guarantee black civil rights in 1877 and the need for a civil rights movement a century later. Nothing ever causes anything. Things just happen. In fact, during Reconstruction and the Nadir, a battle raged for the soul of the Southern white racist, and, in a way, for that of the whole nation. There is a parallel in the Reconstruction of Germany after World War II, a battle for the soul of the German people, a battle which Nazism lost, we hope. But in the United States, as American history tells, racism won. Between 1890 and 1907, every Southern and border state legally disenfranchised the vast majority of its African-American voters. Lynchings rose to an all-time high. In 1897, the Supreme Court upheld segregation in Plessy v. Ferguson. No textbook explains the rationale of segregation, which is crucial to understanding its devastating effect on black and white psyches. Describing the 1954 Supreme Court decision that would begin to undo segregation, the American Way says, "No separate school could truly be equal for blacks, but offers no clue as to why this would be." textbooks need to offer the sociological definition of segregation: a system of racial etiquette that keeps the oppressed group separate from the oppressor when both are doing equal tasks, like learning the multiplication tables, but allows intimate closeness when the tasks are hierarchical, like cooking or cleaning for white employers. The rationale of segregation thus implies that the oppressed are a pariah people. Unclean was the caste message of every colored water fountain, waiting room, and courtroom Bible. Inferior was the implication of every school that excluded blacks, and often Mexicans, Native Americans, and Orientals. This ideology was born in slavery and remained alive to rationalize the second-class citizenship imposed on African Americans after Reconstruction. This stigma is why separate could never mean equal. Even when black facilities might be newer or physically superior, elements of this stigma survive to harm the self-image of some African Americans today, which helps explain why Caribbean blacks who emigrate to the United States often outperform black Americans. During the Nader, segregation increased everywhere. Jackie Robinson was not the first black player in Major League Baseball. Blacks had played in the major leagues in the 19th century, but by 1889, whites had forced them out. In 1911, the Kentucky Derby eliminated black jockeys after they won 15 of the first 28 derbies. Particularly in the South, whites attacked the richest and most successful African Americans, just as they had the most acculturated Native Americans. So upward mobility offered no way out for blacks, but only made them more of a target. In the North, as well as in the South, whites forced African Americans from skilled occupations and even unskilled jobs, such as postal carriers. Eventually, our system of segregation spread to South Africa, to Bermuda, and even to European-controlled enclaves in China. American popular culture evolved to rationalize whites' retraction of civil and political rights from African Americans. The Bronx Zoo exhibited an African behind bars, like a gorilla. Theatrical productions of Uncle Tom's Cabin played throughout the Nader, but since the novel's indictment of slavery was no longer congenial to an increasingly racist white society, rewrites changed Uncle Tom from a martyr who gave his life to protect his people to a sentimental dope who was loyal to kindly masters. In the black community, Uncle Tom eventually came to mean an African-American without integrity who sells out his people's interests. In the 1880s and 1890s, minstrel shows featuring bumbling, mistlocuting whites in blackface grew wildly popular from New England to California. By presenting heavily caricatured images of African Americans who were happy on the plantation and lost and incompetent off it, these shows demeaned black ability. Minstrel songs such as "Carry Me Back to Old Virginny," "Old Black Joe," and "My Old Kentucky Home" told whites that Harriet Beecher Stowe got Uncle Tom's Cabin all wrong. Blacks really liked slavery. Second-class citizenship was appropriate for such a sorry people. Textbooks abandoned their idealistic presentations of Reconstruction in favor of the Confederate myth. For if blacks were inferior, then the historical period in which they enjoyed equal rights must have been dominated by wrong-thinking Americans. Vaudeville continued the portrayal of silly, lying, chicken-stealing black idiots. So did the early silent movies. Some movies made more serious charges against African Americans. D.W. Griffith's racist epic, Birth of a Nation, showed them obsessed with interracial sex and debased by corrupt white carpetbaggers. In politics, the white electorate had become so racist by 1892 that the Democratic candidate, Grover Cleveland, won the White House partly by tarring Republicans with their attempts to guarantee civil rights to African Americans, thereby conjuring fears of Negro domination in the northern as well as southern white mind. From the Civil War to the end of the century, not a single Democrat in Congress, representing the North or the South, ever voted in favor of any civil rights legislation. The Supreme Court was worse. Its segregationist decisions from 1896, Plessy, through 1927, Rice versus Gong Lum, which barred Chinese from white schools, told the nation that whites were the master race. We've seen how Woodrow Wilson won the presidency in 1912 and proceeded to segregate the federal government. Aided by Birth of a Nation, which opened in 1915, the Ku Klux Klan rose to its zenith, boasting over 1 million members. The KKK openly dominated the state government of Indiana for a time, and it proudly inducted President Warren G. Harding as a member in a White House ceremony. During the Wilson and Harding administrations, perhaps 100 race riots took place, more than in any other period since Reconstruction. White mobs killed African Americans across the United States. Some of these events, like the 1919 Chicago riot, are well known. Others, such as the 1921 riot in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in which whites dropped dynamite from airplanes onto a black ghetto, killing more than 75 people and destroying more than 1,100 homes, have completely vanished from our history books. It's almost unimaginable how racist the United States became during and just after the Nader. Mass attacks by whites wiped out or terrorized black communities in the Florida Keys, in Springfield, Illinois, and in the Arkansas Delta, and were an implicit, ever-present threat to every black neighborhood in the nation. Some small communities in the Midwest and West became sundown towns, informally threatening African Americans with death if they remained overnight. African Americans were excluded from juries throughout the South and in many places in the North, which usually meant they could forget about legal redress, even for obvious wrongs like assault, theft, or arson by whites. Lynchings offer evidence of how defenseless blacks were, for the defining characteristic of a lynching is that the murder takes place in public, so everyone knows who did it, yet the crime goes unpunished. During the Nader, lynchings took place as far north as Duluth. Once again, as Dred Scott had proclaimed in 1857, a Negro had no rights a white man was bound to respect. Every time African Americans interacted with European Americans, no matter how insignificant the contact, they had to be aware of how they presented themselves, lest they give offense by looking someone in the eye, forgetting to say, sir, or otherwise stepping out of their place. Always, the threat of overwhelming force lay just beneath the surface. The Nader left African Americans in a dilemma. An exodus to form new black communities in the West didn't lead to real freedom. Migration north led only to segregated urban ghettos. Concentrating on Booker T. Washington's plan for economic improvement while foregoing civil and political rights could not work, because economic gains could not be maintained without civil and political rights. Back to Africa was not practicable. Many African Americans lost hope. Family instability and crime increased. This period of American life, not slavery, marked the beginning of what some social scientists have called the tangle of pathology in African American society. Indeed, some historians date low black morale to even later periods, such as the Great Migration to Northern Cities, 1918 through 1970, the Depression, 1929 to 1939, or changes in urban life and occupational structure after World War II. Unfortunately, no textbook discusses the changing levels of white racism or black reaction to any of these periods. In any event, this tangle was the result, not the cause, of the segregation and discrimination African Americans faced. Black jockeys and mail carriers were shut out, not because they were inadequate, but because they succeeded. Several textbooks point out individual trees in the Nader Forest. From The American Way, students learn that, by the early 1900s, white workers had convinced most labor unions not to admit blacks. Land of Promise teaches that Woodrow Wilson's administration was openly hostile to black people. The United States, A History of the Republic, mentions the exodus to Kansas. 7 textbooks mention the Chicago riot. Several author a description of lynchings. All 12 books mention Plessy versus Ferguson. Life and Liberty reveals that Southern states passed laws that took the vote away from blacks. A History of the Republic, Land of Promise, and the American Pageant provide enough trees that readers might infer some kind of forest, except the 20 pages of unrelated topics usually separate each tree from the next. Only American History and The American Adventure summarize the Nader period. The other 10 textbooks offer no clue that race relations in the United States systematically worsened for almost half a century. None of the textbooks analyzes the cause of the worsening. 6 textbooks imply or state that Jackie Robinson was the first black baseball player ever allowed in the major leagues, in the words of Life and Liberty, even though he wasn't, leaving students with the unmistakable implication of generally uninterrupted progress to the present. Textbook authors would not have to invent their descriptions of the Nader from scratch. African Americans have left a rich and bitter legacy from this period. Students who encounter Richard Wright's narrative of his childhood in Black Boy read Ida B. Wells's description of a lynching in The Red Record, or sing aloud Big Bill Brunzi's If You're Black, Get Back, cannot but understand the plight of a people envisioning only a narrowing of their options. No book can convey the depths of the black experience without including material from the oppressed group. Yet, not one textbook lets African Americans speak for themselves about the conditions they faced. It's also crucial that students realize that the discrimination confronting African Americans during the Nader and afterward was national, not just Southern. Only The American Adventure points this out. Therefore, most of my first-year college students have no idea that in many locales until after World War II, and continuing even today in some suburbs, the North, too, was segregated. That blacks couldn't buy houses in communities around Minneapolis, couldn't work in the construction trades in Philadelphia, wouldn't be hired as department store clerks in Chicago, and so on. Even The American Adventure forgets its own coverage of the Nader, and elsewhere offers this simplistic view of the period. The years 1880 through 1910 seemed full of contradictions. During Reconstruction, many people tried hard to help the black people in the South. Then, for years, most white Americans paid little attention to the blacks. Little by little, however, there grew a new concern for them. The trouble is, many white high school graduates share this worldview. Even if white concern for blacks has been only sporadic, they would argue, why haven't African Americans shaped up in the 100-plus years since Reconstruction ended? After all, immigrant groups didn't have everything handed to them on a platter either. It's true that some immigrant groups faced harsh discrimination, from the No Irish Need Apply signs in Boston, to the lynching of Italian Americans in New Orleans, to the pogroms against Chinese work camps in California. Some white suburban communities in the North still shut out Jews and Catholics. Nonetheless, the segregation and physical violence aimed at African Americans has been of a higher order of magnitude. If African Americans in the Nader had experienced only white indifference, as The American Adventure implies, rather than overt violent resistance, they could have continued to win Kentucky derbies, deliver mail, and even buy houses in white neighborhoods. Their problem was not black failure or white indifference. It was white racism. Although formal racial discrimination grows increasingly rare, as young Americans grow up, they cannot avoid coming up against the rift of race relations. They will encounter predominantly black athletic teams cheered by predominantly white cheerleaders on television, self-segregated dining rooms on college campuses, and arguments about affirmative action in the workplace. More than any other social variable, except sex, race will determine who they marry. Most of their friendship networks will remain segregated by race, and most churches, lodges, and other social organizations will be overwhelmingly either black or non-black. The ethnic incidents and race riots of tomorrow will provoke still more agonizing debate. Since the Nader, the climate of race relations has improved, owing especially to the civil rights movement. But massive racial disparities remain, inequalities that can only be briefly summarized here. In 1990, African-American median family income averaged only 57% of white family income. Native Americans and Hispanics averaged about 65% as much as whites. Money can be used to buy many things in our society, from higher SAT scores to the ability to swim. And African-American, Hispanic, and Native American families lag in their access to all these things. Ultimately, money buys life itself, in the form of better nutrition and health care and freedom from danger and stress. It should therefore come as no surprise that in 1990, African-Americans and Native Americans had median life expectancies at birth that were 6 years shorter than whites. On average, African-Americans have worse housing, lower scores on IQ tests, and higher percentages of young men in jail. The sneaking suspicion that African-Americans might be inferior goes unchallenged in the hearts of many blacks and whites. It's all too easy to blame the victim and conclude that people of color are themselves responsible for being on the bottom. Without causal historical analysis, these racial disparities are impossible to explain. When textbooks make racism invisible in American history, they obstruct our already poor ability to see it in the present. The closest they come to analysis is to present a vague feeling of optimism. In race relations, as in everything, our society is constantly getting better. We used to have slavery, now we don't. We used to have lynchings, now we don't. Baseball used to be all white, now it isn't. The notion of progress suffuses textbook treatments of black-white relations, implying that race relations have somehow steadily improved on their own. This cheery optimism only compounds the problem, because whites can infer that racism is over. The U.S. has done more than any other nation in history to provide equal rights for all, the American tradition assures us. Of course, its authors have not seriously considered the levels of human rights in the Netherlands, Lesotho, or Canada today, or in Choctaw society in 1800, because they don't mean their declaration as a serious statement of comparative history. It's just ethnocentric cheerleading. High school students have a gloomy view of the state of race relations in America today, according to a recent national poll. Students of all racial backgrounds brood about the subject. Another poll reveals that for the first time in this century, young white adults have less tolerant attitudes toward black Americans than those over 30. One reason is that the under 30 generation is pathetically ignorant of recent American history. Too young to have experienced or watched the civil rights movement as it happened, these young people have no understanding of the past and present workings of racism in American society. Educators justify teaching history because it gives us perspective on the present. If there is one issue in the present to which authors should relate the history they tell, the issue is racism. But As long as history textbooks make white racism invisible in the 19th century, neither they nor the students who use them will be able to analyze racism intelligently in the present. Chapter 6. John Brown and Abraham Lincoln. The Invisibility of Anti-Racism in American History Textbooks. It's not only radical or currently unfashionable ideas that the texts leave out. It's all ideas, including those of their heroes. Francis Fitzgerald. You may dispose of me very easily. I am nearly disposed of now. But this question is still to be settled. This Negro question, I mean. The end of that is not yet. John Brown, 1859. I am here to plead his cause with you. I plead not for his life, but for his character, his immortal life, and so it becomes your cause wholly, and not his in the least. Henry David Thoreau. A Plea for Captain John Brown, 1859. We shall need all the anti-slavery feeling in the country, and more. You can go home and try to bring the people to your views, and you may say anything you like about me, if that will help. When the hour comes for dealing with slavery, I trust I will be willing to do my duty, though it cost my life. Abraham Lincoln to Abolitionist Unitarian Ministers, 1862. Perhaps the most telling criticism Frances Fitzgerald made in her 1979 survey of American history textbooks, America Revised, was that they leave out ideas. As presented by textbooks of the 1970s, American political life was completely mindless, she observed. Why would textbook authors avoid even those ideas with which they agree? Taking ideas seriously doesn't fit with the rhetorical style of textbooks, which presents events so as to make them seem foreordained along a line of constant progress. Including ideas would make history contingent. Things could go either way, and have on occasion. The right people armed with the right ideas haven't always won. When they didn't, the authors would be in the embarrassing position of having to disapprove of an outcome in the past. Including ideas would introduce uncertainty. This is not textbook style. Textbooks unfold history without real drama or suspense, only melodrama. On the subject of race relations, John Brown's statement that this question is still to be settled seems as relevant today and even as ominous as when he spoke in 1859. The opposite of racism is anti-racism, of course, or what we might call racial idealism or equalitarianism, and it is still not clear whether it will prevail. In this struggle, our history textbooks offer little help. Just as they underplay white racism, they also neglect racial idealism. In doing so, they deprive students of potential role models to call upon as they try to bridge the new fault lines that will spread out in the future from the great rift in our past. Since ideas and ideologies played an especially important role in the Civil War era, American history textbooks give a singularly inchoate view of that struggle. Just as textbooks treat slavery without racism, they treat abolitionism without much idealism. Consider the most radical white abolitionist of them all, John Brown. The treatment of Brown, like the treatment of slavery and Reconstruction, has changed in American history textbooks. From 1890 to about 1970, John Brown was insane. Before 1890, he was perfectly sane, and after 1970, he regained his sanity. Since Brown himself didn't change after his death, his sanity provides an inadvertent index of the level of white racism in our society. In today's textbooks, Brown makes two appearances, Pottawatomie, Kansas, and Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Recall that the 1854 Kansas-Nebraska Act tried to resolve the question of slavery through popular sovereignty. The practical result of leaving the slavery decision to whoever settled in Kansas was an ideologically motivated settlement craze. Northerners rushed to live and farm in Kansas Territory and make it free soil. Fewer Southern planters moved to Kansas with their slaves, but slave owners from Missouri repeatedly crossed the Missouri River to vote in territorial elections and to establish a reign of terror to drive out free soil farmers. In May 1856, hundreds of pro-slavery border ruffians, as they came to be called, raided the free soil town of Lawrence, Kansas, burning down the hotel and destroying two printing presses. The American tradition describes Brown's actions at Pottawatomie. In retaliation, a militant abolitionist named John Brown led a midnight attack on the pro-slavery settlement of Pottawatomie. 5 people were killed by Brown and his followers. Discovering American History describes Brown's 1859 Harper's Ferry raid. John Brown, son of an abolitionist, envisioned a plan to invade the South and free the slaves. In 1859, with financial support from abolitionists, Brown made plans to start a slave rebellion in Virginia, to establish a free state in the Appalachian Mountains, and to spread the rebellion through the South. On October 16, 1859, Brown and 18 of his men captured the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, in the present state of West Virginia. He and his men were captured by a force of Marines. Brown was brought to trial and convicted of treason against Virginia, murder, and criminal conspiracy. He was hanged on December 2, 1859. In all, 7 of the 12 textbooks take this neutral approach to John Brown. Their bland paragraphs don't imply that Brown was crazy, but neither do they tell enough about him to explain why he became a hero to so many blacks and non-slaveholding whites. 3 textbooks still linger in a former era. John Brown was almost certainly insane, opines American History. The American Way tells a whopper. Later, Brown was proved to be mentally ill. The American Pageant characterizes Brown as deranged, gaunt, grim, terrible, and crack-brained, probably of unsound mind, and says that 13 of his near relatives were regarded as insane, including his mother and grandmother. 2 other books finesse the sanity issue by calling Brown merely fanatical. No textbook has any sympathy for the man or takes any pleasure in his ideals and actions. For the benefit of readers who, like me, grew up reading that Brown was at least fanatical if not crazed, let's consider the evidence. To be sure, some of Brown's lawyers and relatives, hoping to save his neck, suggested an insanity defense. But no one who knew Brown thought him crazy. He favorably impressed people who spoke with him after his capture, including his jailer, and even reporters writing for Democratic newspapers, which supported slavery. Governor Wise of Virginia called him a man of clear head after Brown got the better of him in an informal interview. They are themselves mistaken who take him to be a madman, Governor Wise said. In his message to the Virginia legislature, he said Brown showed quick and clear perception, rational premises and consecutive reasoning, composure and self-possession. After 1890, textbook authors inferred Brown's madness from his plan, which admittedly was far-fetched. Never mind that John Brown himself presciently told Frederick Douglass that the venture would make a stunning impact even if it failed. Nor that his 20-odd followers can hardly all be considered crazed, too. Rather, we must recognize that the insanity with which historians have charged John Brown was never psychological. It was ideological. Brown's actions made no sense to textbook writers between 1890 and about 1970. To make no sense is to be crazy. Clearly, Brown's contemporaries didn't consider him insane. Brown's ideological influence in the month before his hanging and continuing after his death was immense. He moved the boundary of acceptable thoughts and deeds regarding slavery. Before Harper's Ferry, to be an abolitionist wasn't quite acceptable, even in the North. Just talking about freeing slaves, advocating immediate emancipation, was behavior at the outer limit of the ideological continuum. By engaging in armed action, including murder, John Brown made mere verbal abolitionism seem much less radical. After an initial shockwave of revulsion against Brown, in the North as well as the South, Americans were fascinated to hear what he had to say. In his 1859 trial, John Brown captured the attention of the nation like no other abolitionist or slave owners before or since. He knew it. "My whole life before had not afforded me one half the opportunity to plead for the right." In his speech to the court on November 2nd, just before the judge sentenced him to die, Brown argued, "Had I so interfered in behalf of the rich, the powerful, it would have been all right." He referred to the Bible which he saw in the courtroom, "which teaches me that all things whatsoever I would that men should do to me, I should do even so to them. It teaches me further to remember them that are in bonds as bound with them. I endeavor to act up to that instruction." Brown went on to claim the high moral ground. "I believe that to have interfered as I have done, as I have always freely admitted I have done, in behalf of his despised poor, I did no wrong but right." Although he objected that his impending death penalty was unjust, he accepted it and pointed to graver injustices. "Now if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice, and mingle my blood further with the blood of my children and the blood of millions in this slave country, whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel, and unjust enactments, I say, let it be done." Brown's willingness to go to the gallows for what he thought was right had a moral force of its own. It seems as if no man had ever died in America before, for in order to die, you must first have lived, Henry David Thoreau observed in a eulogy in Boston. "These men, in teaching us how to die, have at the same time taught us how to live." Thoreau went on to compare Brown with Jesus of Nazareth, who had faced a similar death at the hands of the state. During the rest of November, Brown provided the nation graceful instruction in how to face death. In Larchmont, New York, George Templeton Strong wrote in his diary, "One's faith in anything is terribly shaken by anybody who is ready to go to the gallows, condemning and denouncing it." Brown's letters to his family and friends softened his image, showed his human side, and prompted an outpouring of sympathy for his children and soon-to-be widow, if not for Brown himself. His letters to supporters and remarks to journalists, widely circulated, formed a continuing indictment of slavery. We see his charisma in this letter from "A Conservative Christian," so the author signed it, written to Brown in jail. "While I cannot approve of all your acts, I stand in awe of your position since your capture, and dare not oppose you, lest I be found fighting against God, for you speak as one having authority, and seem to be strengthened from on high." When Virginia executed John Brown on December 2nd, making him the first American since the founding of the nation to be hanged as a traitor, church bells mourned in cities throughout the North. Louisa May Alcott, William Dean Howells, Herman Melville, John Greenleaf Whittier, and Walt Whitman were among the poets who responded to the event. "The gaze of Europe is fixed at this moment on America," wrote Victor Hugo from France. "Hanging Brown," Hugo predicted, "will open a latent fissure that will finally split the Union asunder. The punishment of John Brown may consolidate slavery in Virginia, but it will certainly shatter the American democracy. You preserve your shame, but you kill your glory." Brown remained controversial after his death. Republican congressmen kept their distance from his felonious acts. Southern slave owners were appalled at the show of Northern sympathy for Brown and resolved to maintain slavery by any means necessary, including quitting the Union if they lost the next election. Brown's charisma in the North, meanwhile, was not spent, but only increased due to what many came to view as his martyrdom. As the war came, as thousands of Americans found themselves making the same commitment to face death that John Brown had made, the force of his example took on new relevance. That's why soldiers marched into battle singing John Brown's Body. 2 years later, church congregations sang Julia Ward Howe's new words to the song, "As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free." And the identification of John Brown and Jesus Christ took another turn. The next year saw the 54th Massachusetts Colored Regiment parading through Boston to the tune, en route to its heroic destiny with death in South Carolina, while William Lloyd Garrison surveyed the cheering bystanders from a balcony, his hand resting on a bust of John Brown. In February 1865, another Massachusetts Colored Regiment marched to the tune through the streets of Charleston, South Carolina. That was the high point of old John Brown. At the turn of the century, as Southern and border states disenfranchised African Americans, as lynchings proliferated, as blackface minstrel shows came to dominate American popular culture, white America abandoned the last shards of its racial idealism. A history published in 1923 makes plain the connection to Brown's insanity. The farther we get away from the excitement of 1859, the more we are disposed to consider this extraordinary man the victim of mental delusions. Not until the civil rights movement of the 1960s was white America freed from enough of its racism to accept that a white person didn't have to be crazy to die for black equality. In a sense, the murders of Mickey Schwerner and Andrew Goodman in Mississippi, James Reeb and Viola Liuzzo in Alabama, and various other white civil rights workers in various other southern states during the 1960s, liberated textbook writers to see sanity again in John Brown. Rise of the American Nation, written in 1961, calls the Harper's Ferry Plan a wild idea certain to fail, while in Triumph of the American Nation, published in 1986, the plan becomes a bold idea, but almost certain to fail. Frequently in American history, the ideological needs of white racists and black nationalists coincide. So it was with their views of John Brown. During the heyday of the Black Power movement, I listened to speaker after speaker in a Mississippi forum denounce whites. "They are your enemies," thundered one black militant. "Not one white person has ever had the best interests of black people at heart." John Brown sprang to my mind, but the speaker anticipated my objection. "You might say John Brown did, but remember, he was crazy." John Brown might provide a defense against such global attacks on whites, but unfortunately, American history textbooks have erased him as a usable character. No black person who met John Brown thought him crazy. Many black leaders of the day, Martin Delaney, Henry Highland Garnett, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, and others, knew and respected Brown. Only illness kept Tubman from joining him at Harper's Ferry. The day of his execution, black-owned businesses closed in mourning across the North. Frederick Douglass called Brown one of the greatest heroes known to American fame. A black college deliberately chose to locate at Harper's Ferry, and in 1918 its alumni dedicated a memorial stone to Brown and his men to commemorate their heroism. The stone stated in part that this nation might have a new birth of freedom, that slavery should be removed forever from American soil. John Brown and his 21 men gave their lives. Quite possibly, textbooks shouldn't portray this murderer as a hero, although other murderers, from Christopher Columbus to Nat Turner, get the heroic treatment. However, the flat prose that textbooks use for Brown isn't really neutral. Textbook authors' withdrawal of sympathy from Brown is perceptible. Their tone in presenting him is different from the tone they employ for almost everyone else. We see this, for instance, in their treatment of his religious beliefs. John Brown was a serious Christian, well read in the Bible, who took its moral commands to heart. Yet our textbooks don't credit Brown with religiosity. Subtly, they blame him for it. Believing himself commanded by God to free the slaves, Brown came up with a scheme, in the words of Land of Promise. The American pageant calls Brown narrowly ignorant, perhaps a euphemism for overly religious, and God's angry man. He believed that God had commanded him to free the slaves by force, states American history. God never commanded Brown in the sense of giving him instructions. Rather, Brown thought deeply about the moral meaning of Christianity, and decided that slavery was incompatible with it. He was also not narrowly ignorant, having traveled widely in the United States, England, and Europe, and talked with many American intellectuals of the day, black and white. By way of comparison, consider Nat Turner, who in 1831 led the most important slave revolt since the United States became a nation. John Brown and Nat Turner both killed whites in cold blood. Both were religious. But unlike Brown, Turner saw visions and heard voices. In most textbooks, Turner has become something of a hero. Several textbooks call Turner deeply religious. None calls him a religious fanatic. They reserve that term for Brown. The closest any textbook comes to suggesting that Turner might have been crazy is this passage from American History. Historians still argue about whether or not Turner was insane. But the author immediately goes on to qualify. The point is that nearly every slave hated bondage. Nearly all were eager to see something done to destroy the system. Thus, even American History emphasizes the political and social meaning of Turner's act, not its psychological genesis in an allegedly questionable mind. The textbook's withdrawal of sympathy from Brown is also apparent in what they include and exclude about his life before Harper's Ferry. In the 1840s, he somehow got interested in helping black slaves, according to American Adventures. Brown's interest is no mystery. He learned it from his father, who was a trustee of Oberlin College, a center of abolitionist sentiment. If Adventures wanted, it could have related the well-known story about how young John made friends with a black boy during the War of 1812, which convinced him that blacks were not inferior. Instead, its sentence reads like a slur. Textbook authors make Brown's Pottawatomie killings seem equally unmotivated by neglecting to tell that the violence in Kansas had hitherto been perpetrated primarily by the pro-slavery side. Indeed, slavery sympathizers had previously killed 6 free soil settlers. Several months after Pottawatomie, at Osawatomie, Kansas, Brown then helped 35 free soil men defend themselves against several hundred marauding pro-slavery men from Missouri, thereby earning the nickname Osawatomie John Brown. Not one textbook mentions what Brown did at Osawatomie, where he was the defender, but 8 of the 12 tell what he did at Pottawatomie, where he was the attacker. Our textbooks also handicap Brown by not letting him speak for himself. Even his jailer let Brown put pen to paper. American History includes 3 important sentences. American Adventures gives us almost 2. The American Pageant reprints 3 sentences from a letter Brown wrote his brother. The other 9 books don't provide even a phrase. Brown's words, which moved a nation, therefore do not move students today. Textbook authors have an additional reason to avoid Brown's ideas. They are tinged with Christianity. Religion has been one of the great inspirations and explanations of human enterprise in this country. Yet textbooks, while they may mention religious organizations such as the Shakers or Christian Science, never treat religious ideas in any period seriously. An in-depth portrayal of Mormonism, Christian Science, or the Methodism of the Great Awakening would be controversial. Mentioning atheism or deism would be even worse. Are you going to tell kids that Thomas Jefferson didn't believe in Jesus? Not me, a textbook editor exclaimed to me. Treating religious ideas neutrally, non-religiously, simply as factors in society, won't do either, for that would likely affect